Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the DeafCast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fifth look at the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman on June 12, 1994. As always, before we get into it this week, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the DeafCast, DeafCast Podcast, or DeafCast Official. You can find me on most social media platforms under any one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways that you can do that. First is you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. You should also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. And if you really enjoy what I do and want the best way that you can support the show, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcast. Patreon, where for as little as $2 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. What do I mean by exclusive content? I mean series that I'm not going to put into the free feed, such as the series I did on Columbine as well as the Vince McMahon saga that is currently unfurling before us in the media. Speaking of Patreon, I have to make mention of my very first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. As always, you guys are awesome. Your support is greatly appreciated. One last thing, I want to give a shout out to a friend of mine by the name of Jamie Ward. Jamie does a podcast called Regional Wrestling Territory Talk. If you've been following my show for a while, you know I'm a big fan of old school wrestling, and Jamie does a fantastic job with his co-host, Ray. They release weekly. Right now, they're bouncing back and forth. Georgia Championship Wrestling in 1981, the UWF in 1986, and Memphis in 1985. If you're a fan of that type of thing, please go check them out. Again, that show is Regional Wrestling. That's RASSLIN, Territory Talk. I really think you'll enjoy it. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back, relax, get yourself a drink. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, the officers in the LAPD were preparing themselves to issue an arrest warrant for Orenthal James Simpson for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. Now, this is pretty quick when you consider the fact that the murders had taken place on the 12th, and now here it is the 16th, and they're already really working towards this. They've been talking with the prosecutor's office, specifically Marcia Clark, who I will point out was already at this point causing problems within the investigation as she was circumventing the officer's authority in trying to get information and blood work analysis done faster. And this is something that's going to continue on in this case, is Marcia Clark continuing to muck things up. I said this last episode, some people took issue with it, but I'm sorry, the facts bear repeating. This case was, on the surface, just right for her, but in practice was way over Marcia Clark's head. I don't know whether it was she got starstruck or she was intimidated by being pitted against the dream team that O.J. Simpson put together for his defense team. Whatever the case may be, Marcia just absolutely fudged this case from the get-go, pushing for information, bringing it to trial. It's also my opinion there's a good chance that they may have rushed getting the case to trial, and that is in large part due to Marcia Clark, but also due to the media interest that was really spinning up at this point. 1994, we really hadn't had this type of coverage. Yes, there had been other cases that were called the crime of the century, the case of the century. It's my contention that the O.J. Simpson murder trial is the grand champion in terms of holding that title, because nothing before or since has ever gotten the type of media attention that this case got and continues to get. Give you an example, O.J. Simpson gets a Twitter account or gets a TikTok account, it's headline news. But I digress. Also on the 16th, Nicole Brown Simpson is laid to rest in Mission Viejo. O.J. Simpson was in attendance at the service, which was an open casket service, and there was a bit of a media firestorm over the fact that O.J. whispered to Nicole's corpse and kissed her inside of the casket. After this fact, O.J. returned to his Rockingham estate, where obviously reporters were waiting, as O.J. jumped from the vehicle, covered his face, and sprinted into the home. You can already see, just with this kind of activity, how serious this case is getting within the media. They've really got their teeth in it. It is almost a constant barrage round the clock of coverage. For the officers, they learned that a off-duty LAPD officer was working security for O.J. Simpson. This is going to cause problems later on down the line, because there are a lot of instances such as this and witnesses giving statements to television channels and even being paid for those statements that are going to poke holes in the prosecution's case, because now these individuals are no longer seen as credible or untainted. Friday, June 17th, Lange and Van Atter officially file the case against O.J. Simpson, case number BA097211, with the district attorney's office at 7:20 a.m. After walking Marcia Clark and others through the case that they have prepared, they begin working on the arrest warrant. They also inform Simpson's attorney, Robert Shapiro, that they are going to be issuing an arrest warrant for O.J. Simpson that day, and that they would like O.J. to turn himself into law enforcement. Some people hear this particular fact and they're rather stunned by it, thinking, why would a suspect turn themselves in? Well, there's a couple of reasons. Trying to avoid any sort of media backlash, particularly in this case where the media is already over it, coast to coast. But there's also the possibility that Simpson, assuming he's not in a right state of mind, may cause an incident that could be anything from resisting arrest to a violent act to even possible suicide. But thirdly, they want to see how the suspect is going to react. Oftentimes, if a suspect will turn themselves in, it's seen as an act of good faith, and the prosecution may not push to have said suspect held in remand for so long or have such a high bond to get out. And from a jury standpoint, when a suspect turns them in, that is sometimes seen as the suspect standing by their assertion that they are not in fact guilty for the crime of which they're being accused. According to the officers, upon learning that Simpson's arrest is imminent, the defense attorney seemed taken aback and was unprepared for this, and in fact asked for an 11 a.m. deadline so that he could talk to Simpson and get this arranged. The officers then speak with the district attorney's office, who agrees to this, and it's decided that Simpson will turn himself in at 11 a.m. Shapiro is informed of this, and the officers continue on with their morning, again, preparing the arrest warrant, trying to make certain that all of their ducks are in a row, as they know that every single action that they take is going to be heavily scrutinized, not only by the defense attorneys and the court, but also by the news media. After the arrest warrant is, in fact, written out, Clark and Van Adder leave the DA's office to get a judge to sign it. Lang, still at the DA's office, contacts the captain for his precinct and is informed that while they want Simpson to turn himself in, they want him to turn himself in at the jail located in the back of the Park Center station. Now, this is a very open area to both the public and to the media, and Leng very quickly ascertains that the higher-ups within the LAPD are looking for a PR stunt with Simpson's arrest, because it's already so saturating the news that they want to have some good publicity for the police department to show the community that, look, see, even if you are a very well-known, wealthy celebrity, you're not above the law. Lang also realizes that this is going to be an absolute nightmare of a scenario, given how big the case has already become in the media, and the almost insatiable appetite for every single aspect of it that the general public has quickly developed. Armed with this information, Lang then contacts Shapiro and informs him of the change in plans. And according to Lang, Shapiro then informs him that Simpson is extremely depressed, and being that Simpson is so much larger than Lang, Shapiro doesn't believe that he'll be able to handle him if Simpson decides to do something drastic. Nobody knew it at the time, but this really was foreshadowing for what was going to play out later in the day. Lang also informs Shapiro that if Simpson does not turn himself in at the prearranged time of 11 a.m., then the LAPD will be forced to come and get Simpson. And it's later learned that Shapiro had spoken to Lang's chief and informed him that Simpson would be turning himself in, but that he would be later, as Simpson was saying goodbye to friends and family, as well as taking care of personal business. There was also a statement made that Simpson was under the care of a doctor and was being sedated. So this is around 10:15, 10:20 or so. It was noted that during this period of time, news of Simpson's impending arrest had leaked, and reporters were beginning to descend on Parker Center. And this is something that's going to plague both the investigation as well as the coming courtroom drama, is leaks within the case to the media. Obviously, 11 o'clock comes and goes, and there is no sign of Simpson. And give you an idea of what a big deal this is, the LAPD has helicopters up circling the building. There are also helicopters from news reporters up there circling as well. And the LAPD even goes so far as to get SWAT involved, as they fear that Simpson may be the victim of an assassination attempt. At 11:05, they receive another phone call from Shapiro, who stated, quote, Simpson is now talking to his children, is still working on his will. Two doctors, two friends, and Simpson's personal attorney are present along with Shapiro. Shapiro calls again at 11:45, stating that they would be there and they would be coming in two cars, a black Isuzu, along with a white Bronco, in which A.C. Callings would be driving Simpson, stating that they estimate a 30-minute drive, so right around 12:15. By this point, the LAPD is starting to get antsy, and they let Shapiro know, look, Simpson needs to turn himself in now. No more of this nonsense with, you know, stalling and saying goodbye to everyone. At 11:35, the commander for the precinct contacts Shapiro at his office, and after some transfers, the commander is connected to a home where Shapiro is at. Shapiro refuses to give up their location, pleading for more time. Now, according to notes from this conversation, Shapiro stated Simpson is, quote, making a will because he said he will be in prison for the rest of his life. He is also saying goodbye to friends. The precinct commander refuses to give Shapiro more time. And I think it's pretty telling that Shapiro comes out with this line about Simpson stating that he's going to be in prison for the rest of his life. The commander then informs Shapiro that if Simpson does not turn himself in, or the location where Simpson is currently hiding out is not giving, they will consider that Shapiro is harboring a fugitive and will be prosecuted as such. It's at this point that they learn Simpson is at Robert Kardashian's home. You most likely know the name of Robert Kardashian, his ex-wife and his succubi children have become media darlings for being little more than plastic molded trollops who, I'm sorry, they don't do anything to contribute to society. They're just bodies that many men like to look at, who got famous because E! Television Network decided to give them a television show, and then the oldest decided to put out a porno video, which was quote-unquote accidentally released. There was no accident in that. It was all a carefully orchestrated PR maneuver in order for her to become famous. They are useless eaters. At 12:50, the Robbery and Homicide Division contacts the West Valley Division, which is another precinct, and asks them to send officers and a supervisor over to the Kardashian home in order to take O.J. Simpson into custody. He learns that the commander from the station has also headed out there and has, in fact, dispatched two black and white cars without lights or sirens. Not long after this, the Robbery and Homicide Division receive a report, at that point unconfirmed, that Simpson and Callings have both left the Kardashian home. Those present include Simpson's personal physician, a psychologist by the name of Dr. Michael Baden, Shapiro, Kardashian, Dr. Henry Lee, who is a noted criminalist, and a professor from UCLA. No one present in the home claimed to know the location of either Simpson or Cowling. From this point forward, the Kardashian home is basically locked down, with no one allowed to enter without signing into a police log, and no one allowed to leave. They learn that Simpson's girlfriend, Paula Barberi, who they later learned had been with Simpson earlier that day, had also just left the Kardashian home with her talent agent. Obviously, these are two individuals the police want to interview, and this is quickly done. Again, no one knows Simpson's whereabouts. And the police are informed that his girlfriend believes OJ to be suicidal. At 1:40 a.m., detectives in the robbery homicide division receive a phone call from the Kardashian home that Simpson and Cowlings have gone on the run and that Simpson is believed to be suicidal. Right after getting this information, they receive another phone call. This one stating that Simpson and Cowlings are in a white 1993 Ford Bronco that belongs to Al Cowlings, and it's a very similar model to the 1994 version that Simpson himself drove. Simpson is listed as wearing a yellow golf shirt, faded blue jeans, and white Reeboks, while Cowlings is dressed in a black shirt, black pants, and black shoes. And this is really where the shit hits the fan. If you lived through what's coming, you know just how big a deal it was. If you didn't live through it, you more likely than not have seen clips of it and have also seen it spoofed in numerous forms of media. After getting this phone call that Simpson is fleeing with Cowlings in the Bronco, they get another phone call from the West Los Angeles Police Department, who had just received a phone call from Lou Brown, Nicole's father. Nicole's father had gotten a phone call from O.J. Simpson stating that he was on his way over to the South Bundy property. This, in turn, prompted Lou to contact the police, who in turn contact the Robbery Homicide Division. Police are dispatched to a condo where Nicole had lived, and as the detectives in the Robbery Homicide Division tensely wait to find out what's going on, they receive another phone call, this from officers at the Kardashian house, where a suicide letter penned by Simpson has been discovered. Now, at around 2 o'clock on this date, the 16th, the police have a press conference, and I am going to read these statements as I was unable to find an unaltered news clip of this particular press conference. Quote, "This morning, detectives from the Los Angeles Police Department, after an exhaustive investigation which included interviews with dozens of witnesses, a thorough examination and analysis of the physical evidence both here and in Chicago, sought and obtained a warrant for the arrest of O.J. Simpson, charging him with the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman. Mr. Simpson, in agreement with his attorney, was scheduled to surrender this morning to the Los Angeles Police Department. Initially, that was at 11 o'clock. It then became 11:45. Mr. Simpson has not appeared. The Los Angeles Police Department right now is actively searching for Mr. Simpson. Mr. Simpson is out there somewhere, and we will find him." This news conference causes a flurry of activity in both the Robbery Homicide Division as well as in police precincts all over the city as citizens begin calling in tips regarding O.J. Simpson. There are also those who are worried, you know, is he out there? Is he going to kill us? That type of thing. Handling all of this, the officers then go into putting out an all-points bulletin for Orenthal, James Simpson, and Al Callings. Part of this includes notifying U.S. Customs, but they also need to notify the Border Patrol. Not just the border with Mexico, but also to the north in Canada. As O.J. Simpson is officially declared a fugitive from justice. Again, as I stated, numerous tips come in concerning O.J. This compilation of tips comes from the book Evidence Dismissed, The Inside Story of the People versus O.J. Simpson. These are the most interesting tips. Quote, O.J. can leave the area by boat. Jermaine Jackson had O.J. flown out of the area. Psychic from Florida states he is hiding at a local dry cleaning store. Caller states she saw a well-built black man with sunglasses and a new black Mercedes-Benz going north on Highland Avenue resembled O.J. Anonymous caller whereabouts of O.J. San Diego Point Loma Hotel, Posada, Best Western Inn. O.J. is a friend who rented a room in friend's name between 9 and 11 a.m. Unknown tipster said he saw O.J. there today. Anonymous caller. O.J. owns two condos at Monarch Beach in Orange County. Caller said O.J. may be going there. Operator 514 stated male caller from payphone at corner of Van Auer and Woodman saw O.J. gas his Rolls Royce at 1540 hours 76 station. Caller saw O.J. in a white Rolls Royce going north towards Sun Valley. Mail source states O.J. is with Magic Johnson, or Magic knows where he is. At 5 p.m., Robert Shapiro takes to the airways. Shapiro reads a statement, quote, O.J., wherever you are, for the sake of your family, for the sake of your children, please surrender immediately. Surrender to any law enforcement official at any police station, but please do it immediately. After this, Robert Kardashian steps up to the podium and reads the following letter. I am going to be playing audio here for you of Kardashian reading this letter.
This letter was written by O.J. today. To whom it may concern. First, everyone understand, I had nothing to do with Nicole's murder. I loved her, always have, and always will. If we had a problem, it's because I loved her so much. Recently, we came to the understanding that for now, we were not right for each other, at least for now. Despite our love, we were different, and that's why we mutually agreed to go our separate ways. It was tough splitting for a second time, but we both knew it was for the best. Inside, I had no doubt that in the future, we would be close friends or more. Unlike what has been written in the press, Nicole and I had a great relationship for most of our lives together. Like all long-term relationships, we had a few downs and ups. I took the heat New Year's 1989 because that's what I was supposed to do. I did not plead no contest for any other reason but to protect our privacy, and was advised it would end the press hype. I don't want to belabor knocking the press. But I can't believe what is being said. Most of it is totally made up. I know you have a job to do, but as a last wish, please, please, please leave my children in peace. Their lives will be tough enough. I want to send my love and thanks to all my friends. I'm sorry I can't name every one of you, especially AC, man, thanks for being in my life. The support and friendship I received from so many, Wayne Hughes, Lewis Marks, Frank Olson, Mark Packer, Bender, Bobby Kardashian. I wish we had spent more time together in recent years. My golfing buddies, us, Alan Austin, Mike, Craig, Bender, Weiler, Sandy, Jay, Donnie, thanks for the fun. All my teammates over the years, Reggie, you were soul of my pro career. Ahmad, I never stopped being proud of you. Marcus, you got a great lady in Catherine. Don't mess it up. Bobby Chandler, thanks for always being there. Skip and Kathy, I love you guys. Without you, I never would have made it through this far. Marguerite, thanks for the early years. We had some fun. Paula, what can I say? You are special. I'm sorry, we're not going to have our chance. God brought you to me. I now see as I leave, you'll be in my thoughts. I think of my life and feel I've done most of the right things. So why do I end up like this? I can't go on. No matter what the outcome, people will look and point. I can't take that. I can't subject my children to that. This way, they can move on and go on with their lives. Please, if I've done anything worthwhile in my life, let my kids live in peace from you, the press. I've had a good life. I'm proud of how I lived. My mama taught me to do unto others. I treated people the way I wanted to be treated. I've always tried to be up and helpful. So why is this happening? I'm sorry for the Goldman family. I know how much it hurts. Nicole and I had a good life together. All this press talk about a rocky relationship was no more than that, no more than what every long-term relationship experiences. All her friends will confirm that I have been totally loving and understanding of what she's been going through. At times, I have felt like a battered husband or boyfriend, but I loved her. Make that clear to everyone. And I would take whatever it took to make it work. Don't feel sorry for me. I've had a great life, great friends. Please think of the real OJ and not this lost person. Thanks for making my life special. I hope I helped yours. Peace and love, OJ.
Up until this point, the media had been like a pack of vultures circling over everything having to do with the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. With this information, they go into a full-on feeding frenzy. If you're younger, you can ask people who were alive during this period of time, and they will tell you, this was unlike anything else that we had seen. I'm not exaggerating when I state that the only news coverage I can compare it to was September 11th of 2001, when the airplanes crashed in the World Trade Centers. When it was announced that they were doing this press conference, every feed in America was basically interrupted for this and the preceding events. There's a pro wrestling manager by the name of Jim Cornette, who I'm lucky enough to consider an acquaintance, and he has talked about this date in particular. He was running a very large show in Tennessee, and the show was an absolute flop because of what is about to happen. It grabbed everyone in America's attention and had them glued to their television screens like nothing else ever had. This was like Kennedy being assassinated or the moon landing, but on a much grander scale. This is the type of thing that there was no escaping. I mean, at this point in time, growing up, we didn't have cable television, and this was on all 12 channels. For those who are too young to know what I'm talking about, before everybody had cable television, DirecTV, streaming, there were 12 channels. Where I lived, we had Channel 2, Channel 3, which was static, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 6, and Channel 7, which were the same thing, Channel 8, which was static, Channel 9, Channel 10, 11, 12, which was static, and 13, which was PBS. Now, of all of those that weren't static, this news was all over it. It was also on UHF stations, which were a much lower frequency television station that oftentimes would put out, you know, shows that people made themselves. We used to call it public access. So now police and media attention, which is already through the roof, is amplified exponentially. The police, because they have a suspect they believe is going to commit suicide. The media, because they have a famous fugitive from justice who they think is going to commit suicide, and maybe they can get it on camera. Inside the robbery and homicide division, Detective Lang and Van Adder end up getting into something of a friendly argument, as Van Adder doesn't believe that Simpson is going to kill himself. In fact, he would later state that upon hearing it, he believed that this was an admission of guilt. And then they get a phone call from the district attorney's office that a executive from a cellular phone company whom Simpson has a phone through has contacted them and informed them that Simpson is using his cellular phone. And the executive is able to inform the police that the phone calls are coming from the 405 freeway for the most part. This is pretty amazing technology when you consider the fact that it's 1994. Most people, when they think of cellular phones, think of them more in a modern terms, especially when it comes to cases of true crime. We know that the police can ping you off of cell phone towers and things of that nature, and very often now they are able to place a suspect in a given area where a crime has been committed, or where they believe a crime has been committed, or in an area where a victim's remains are found or where they were last seen. In 1994, very few people beyond the extremely wealthy had access to cellular phones. And it was almost unheard of for the cellular phone companies to use the equipment that they had in order to aid police in tracking down a suspect. But that is exactly what we have here. According to the Orange County Police Department logbook, quote, 1725, LAPD homicide said they've been tracking cellular phone calls being made from a white Bronco thought to contain O.J. Simpson and a friend, Al Cowlings, who is now wanted for aiding a fugitive. The last call came from SB I-5 at El Toro Y at 1646 hours. The vehicle belonging to Cowlings bears license 3DHY503, Control 1 was contacted and a red broadcast was made. Info was also relayed to San Diego County via Control 1. A half an hour later, the Orange County police are contacted again that more cellular phone calls have been traced. And this is when calls about Simpson really begin pouring in as he and Al Cowlings are seen driving up and down the freeway. Not only are police in on this, but the media is as well, with numerous police and media helicopters following what would later be called the Bronco Chase. It was really a low-speed chase with Al Cowlings driving around while O.J. Simpson lay in the back seat with a gun talking about killing himself. This information, the images from this, are burned into the minds of multiple generations of Americans. And I'm actually going to play a news clip at this point. I'm going to play a sound recording from KTVU in San Francisco of O.J. Simpson's Bronco Chase, just a small section so you can hear what it was like.
The intersection of the 5 and the 91 freeway. One thing we have been noticing, again, it's a very slow pursuit, followed by numerous highway patrol vehicles, but because of the intensity, it seems like people have heard about what's going on, and all the overpasses that we've seen have been lined with what has been going on down below as the presumed vehicle of O.J. Simpson is still traveling very slowly northbound along the 5 freeway, coming up again towards the 91 intersection. At that point, we'll just have to wait and see which way he's going to go. But at this point, it's still a fairly laid-back situation, a dangerous situation at the same time, because, again, the Highway Patrol does not want to intimidate, and I repeat, do not want to intimidate this vehicle into doing anything that they really don't want him to do. And the main thing is to get him pulled over as safely as possible. And there's only a couple ways that'll happen. One is him just pulling over and or running out of gas. So at this point, we can only pray that they'll be able to pull this off in a safe measure.
Now, a number of things begin to happen at this point as the LAPD sees for themselves what is going on. Again, this is being broadcast all over the nation live as it happens in the areas that the Bronco is passing through. People are starting to line up on sidewalks and cheer them on. While inside the Bronco, it's a scene of tense chaos. Again, some officers and many in the media and in the public believe that O.J. Simpson was just blowing smoke because of the stress of the situation and the fact that he doesn't believe he should have been charged for the murders, while others think that he was serious about that. I'm going to leave that up to the interpretation of the listener to decide whether or not they think OJ was serious. A arrest warrant is issued for Al Cowlings for harboring a fugitive, with a preliminary bail set at $250,000. The officers would later state that as this Bronco chase progressed, they had a surreal feeling overtake them, which is understandable because the majority of the country was feeling the exact same thing. We had not, except for 9/11, still have not seen anything like this that has had us riveted to our screens to the point that the outside world was shut out. Everything else was forgotten. The only thing that mattered was O.J. Simpson is in a Bronco. He's going up and down the freeways in California, and very shortly, the police are going to get involved and begin to follow him. Eventually, O.J. and Cowlings begin to head back towards Los Angeles. And it's during this that the Robbery and Homicide Division learns that Cowlings has refused to pull over despite numerous warnings from the Orange County Police Department. Cowlings has slowed his vehicle down to 40 to 45 miles an hour and put the hazard lights on. And reports that they are getting in the Robbery Homicide Division is that OJ can be seen inside the Bronco with a gun to his head. Just after receiving this information, they learned that Cowlings has contacted the police and let them know that OJ is in the back of the Bronco with a gun to his head. He's threatening to kill himself. stating that the police need to back off from them because he doesn't know what OJ is going to do. And he requests that the police allow them to get back to OJ's house at North Rockingham. Because of this, the hostage negotiation team as well as the SWAT team is deployed to the Simpson household. Soon, the cars from the Orange County Police Department are joined by those of the LAPD as this strange parade makes its way towards OJ's home. And as they get closer to Simpson's home, the officers in the robbery and homicide division come to the realization that Simpson had given them his cellular phone number, and it's Officer Tom Lang who actually reaches out to O.J. Simpson while he's in the Bronco, eventually making contact with Simpson at 7:26 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And they talk, getting cut off at times, either because Simpson has hung up on him or they have lost the signal, but Lang continues to talk with Simpson as he and Cowlings drive around through Los Angeles. A transcript of a part of that one of those phone calls reads, quote, Simpson, just let me get to my house, please. Lang, okay, we're gonna do that. Simpson, I swear to you, I'll give you my whole body. Lang, okay. Simpson, I just need to get to my house where I lived with Nicole. Lang, okay, we're gonna do that. Just throw the gun out the window. Simpson, I can't do that. Lang, we're not gonna bother you. We're gonna let you go up there. Just throw it out the window. Please, you're scaring everybody, OJ. Are you there? Simpson, this is for me. This is not to keep you guys away from me. This is for me. Lang, I know that. Nobody's gonna hurt you. Simpson, this is for me. Lang, okay, it's for you. I know that. But do it for... Simpson, this is for me. For me. That's all. Lang, I know that. I know that. But do it for the kids, too, will you? Simpson, how? Lang, think of your kids. Simpson, how? Lang, please just toss it out. You're scaring everybody, man. This continues on with Lang pleading with Simpson to get rid of the gun. Eventually, at 7:57 p.m., the Bronco bearing O.J. Simpson pulls into the driveway of his home. And although Detective Lang is still on the line with Simpson, he is no longer responding as Lang pleads with him to drop the gun. I can hear Cowlings pleading with Simpson not to do this, not to commit suicide. Quote, OJ, please, don't you get OJ, no, don't run away from here. Simpson, oh. Cowlings, OJ, I'm begging you, don't do it, OJ, it isn't worth it for your kids and me, OJ. OJ, don't do it, don't just leave, man, don't make me they got you, OJ. Simpson, ah. Cowlings, please listen to me, OJ, listen to me. Simpson, fuck off. Cowlings, please, I beg of you, man, OJ, no, OJ, think about the babies. Simpson, oh. Cowlings, hey, they lost their mother, OJ. Simpson, oh. Eventually, the LAPD negotiator gets involved, and this continues with OJ letting them know that he's not gonna hurt anybody. And this goes on for an extended period of time until roughly 8:45 p.m., where the officers in the robbery homicide division see the light inside of Al Cowling's Bronco go on, and OJ, clutching photographs of his family, steps from the vehicle before collapsing into the officers who are standing there waiting for him. When Simpson is eventually brought into the Park Center at a little after 9 p.m., the officers present made note that Simpson seemed rather haughty, and they got the sense from him that Simpson felt more embarrassed over the entire situation and what it would do to his reputation than he did anything else that had happened. Van Adder goes to deal with Cowlings, who has been brought to the robbery homicide division, while Detective Tom Lang goes with Simpson through the booking procedure. And Lang takes the step of requesting that Simpson be placed in an isolated cell away from other prisoners under suicide watch. The police are in the process of going over Cowling's vehicle, which has been taken into police custody. Inside of it, they find Simpson's .357 Magnum, a cell phone, along with the phone number for the mortuary where Nicole had been handled after being turned over to the family. They also find the travel bag that OJ had with him on the 13th when he returned to Los Angeles. Inside of this, they find his passport, his NFL Hall of Fame ring, numerous credit cards, kits to disguise himself, toiletries, and other various items, leading them to believe that Simpson's initial plan was more likely than not to flee the country. As for AC Cowlings, officers discover nearly $9,000 in cash on him, which OJ had given him, stating that Simpson had wanted him to give the money to the children. In questioning Cowlings, they learn that he and Simpson are best friends, according to the official transcript of the conversation that was Cowlings. Cowlings states, OJ needed to get some rest and didn't want to be hounded by the media, so he asked me to pretend to be him. OJ's security guys rushed me into the house. OJ goes to Bob Kardashian's house over in Encino, spend the night. The next morning, I went over to Kardashian's to be with OJ and the others, Bob Kardashian, Bob Shapiro, and some of the doctors. Lang, did you know that we had a warrant for Simpson's arrest? Cowlings, yeah, I knew about it. OJ was very upset about it. He was crying while I was with him this morning. He wrote some letters. Lang, did you know what they said? Cowlings, no, I never read them. He didn't tell me what he wrote. I did think he wanted to kill himself. Van Adder, what else was going on in the house? Cowlings, I remember that the doctor came and examined him. They took some blood and hair samples for him. Cowlings then goes on to discuss how later that afternoon, the rest of the people in the Kardashian home were upstairs, while he was downstairs with Simpson, who was inconsolable, before admitting that Simpson asked him to drive to Nicole's grave. Van Adder, did anyone tell you that uniformed officers were on their way to Kardashian's house to pick up Simpson? Cowlings, no, no one told me that. I knew about the warrant. I knew that OJ was going to be arrested for murdering Nicole, but when he asked me to drive him to the cemetery, I agreed to do it. I just agreed. He's my friend, so we just walked outside. I don't think anyone upstairs knew when we left. We just split. We were gone. We left in my Bronco. Cowlings then states that after they left the Kardashian home is when OJ showed him the .350 Magnum and that he first began talking about ending his own life before trailing off. Van Adder, where did you go? Cowlings, to the cemetery. We went to Nicole's grave at the cemetery in Orange County. Van Adder, how long were the two of you at the cemetery? Cowlings, not long. There was a couple of uniforms in a police car, and we thought they might be looking for us. We hid my car in an orange grove. But while we were at the cemetery, OJ started talking again about suicide. I thought for sure that he was going to kill himself, so I just started talking to him. I told him that I was going to drive him back to his home. And then Cowlings explains that this is how the low-speed chase began, with him driving back towards OJ's home and OJ bemoaning everything that has happened and talking about killing himself. When asked whether or not he believed OJ had done it, Cowlings simply replied, "I don't know. You have a lot of evidence." After this, Cowlings is booked for aiding and abetting a fugitive. So we are going to end this particular episode here, with Simpson and Cowlings now both in custody of the Los Angeles Police Department, and we will pick it back up next week with everything that happens after this point when OJ has been arrested, and the media circus, which is already in full effect, starts putting up tents and shooting off bottle rockets and everything else, and the entire country, which is already enthralled, begins to spend many sleepless nights watching cable channels like Court TV as the talking heads of the media discuss every single aspect of this case to the point that it was almost a mental illness. Until next week, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid!